Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to Flow Guitar Enthusiasts with Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players, explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, we welcome back legendary session musician and guitar designer Buzzy Featon. He returns to talk about his guitars that he designs and his session work he's done with people like Aretha Franklin and Paul Butterfield Blue Band. So make sure you listen tonight. If you want to check out Sweetwater at www.sweetwater.com, they sponsor our show and we would love to have you visit them. Make sure you listen. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm so lost right now.
And here's Scott Sill and Jeff. Myself.
Holy crap.
Hey, Scott.
Hi. How's it going?
How you doing? It's a Monday.
I'm stoned, apparently. I don't know. I'm a little flabbergasted.
That's okay. Everybody, welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. The reason that he is flabbergasted is we just shot a little video before the show, and it was pretty amazing. He was demonstrating how sensitive our hands. Buzzy was demonstrating how sensitive our hands are to the shape and the, you know, just a little difference in the shape. And we have it. It'll be up on. We'll post it up on the Facebook on Selenium. But anyway, it was amazing, and we were pretty blown away by how much the difference just by a little bit of sanding. And we'll get into that a little later in the show. Anyway, what have you been up to?
Just preparing for NAMM and clearly being a complete spacehead.
So, well, it's going to be a busy show. Yeah. We've got a lot of people to see and a lot of cool stuff.
I am, yeah. I'm a little lost at the moment, apparently. But that's all right. I'm here.
Okay. So I did get my the guitars back, Monique. Thank you very much. We put some LR bags into my Martin and my friend's Gibson. And we'll be setting up a show with Larry Bags. And we will talk about that and demo it live and compare it. We'll mic the guitars and play them through the pickups, so it's pretty cool. Also, too, this weekend I got to see Ed Gerhardt, amazing guitar player, and he uses an interesting lap steel type of acoustic thing. His tone on that thing's amazing. It begins with a W. I always forget the name of the guitar.
Weisenborn.
That's it. Weisenborn. See, he knows. Anyway, it was amazing. I mean, what he was doing, the sustain, and he was getting like weird harmonics, like almost like feedback
I don't know where I pulled that up, really.
No, you know your guitars.
Not really.
But anyway, it was pretty amazing, and we will be having him on the show. He's based back east, but I'm trying to get him in studio, and just keep your fingers crossed. He should be back in town, I think, in August. We're going to try to set that up. It's a really good one. Talk about acoustic tone. This guy's amazing. I mean, he uses Breedlove and that guitar.
Yeah.
So anyway, okay, well, listen, we got to get into it. There's just so much we have to talk with Buzz. And we'll take a break right now, and we'll be back with Buzz Featon.
Hi, Kenny Burgle here from Sweetwater. We're super happy to support Jeff and Scott and the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show on LA Talk Radio. You can see all the specs and pics of your favorite gear and amazingly low prices online at sweetwater.com or call us at 800-222-4700. Every week, Jeff and Scott welcome heavy experts and industry mavens exploring the coolest guitars and basses, pedals, amps, strings, accessories, everything you need to rock. Sweetwater sells all that cool stuff, so listen to the Flow and then check it out online at sweetwater.com or call one of our pro guitar enthusiasts at 800-222-4700. Don't forget that Sweetwater has 24 months equal payments, no interest financing available too. Check that out at the bottom of every Sweetwater webpage where it says easy financing and hit the red Apply Now button. Thanks for listening. This is Kenny Burgle and Sweetwater saying, rock on with the flow.
Hi, this is Elliot Easton of The Empty Hearts, and you're listening to Scott and Jeff on the Flow Guitar Enthusiasts.
We are back, and it's really a pleasure to have Buzz back on the show.
Yep.
And today we're going to be talking guitars, especially his guitars. And what's really cool, we discussed this a little, because last the time he was here, he was talking about Andy Fuchs amps. But what we were talking about before and after the show was what he did to get to where he got his guitars where he wanted them to be. He did a lot of research, and a lot of it was like trying this, trying that, experimenting with neck shapes, body shapes, pickup sounds, bridges, woods, the whole shot. And to me, that's the whole story. It's really fascinating what he's learned from doing all of this stuff. And how his guitars are, why they're made the way, everything that he does on those guitars, selection of woods, the shape, the width of the neck, all of that stuff is for a reason. So it's great to have you back, Buzz.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate it.
It's great. Well, listen, let's just dig right in. And what I wanted to ask you, if everybody also check out buzzfeetandguitars.com. His website, it goes through all the different guitars and the features and stuff that he has on them. And one of the things I wanted to – well, I want to go down the line on how you develop this guitar, because you basically, over the years doing all your session work, you were playing all sorts of guitars and all sorts of really cool guitars. And you basically – these models are a result of what you were looking for as the ultimate playing, that you would – that you'd want to take on a gig and use. Correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
So now you mentioned on your site, which I thought was kind of interesting, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about this, is that you use the basic body. Let's get to the body first.
Sure.
You use an alder core on all of your guitars. Uh-huh. And then you use, whether it's spruce, sugar pine, swamp ash, or flame maple for the top.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why? Well, first of all, I want to ask, what's the difference in those woods on the top? And why not a solid ash or not a solid? I mean, alder's cool. I mean, a lot of the vintage Fenders were alder.
Yeah. Well, I don't consider myself like a creator particularly of anything or an innovator of anything. I'm more of an observer. I just try to observe stuff, like observe what makes me feel good as a player, and I just sort of observed over the years that every time I really liked the tone of a guitar where it had that tight bottom, that tight low, warm, rich low mid-range, it turned out to be an alder guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Just every time. And I kept, I had guitars made from, swamp ash and, cayenne or mahogany or maple or a variety of different woods, spruce. And I kept coming back to the alder just because of that warm low mids, the tight bottom end and warm low mids. And that wood just has that property about it. It's got low mid range. And some swamp ash does, but a lot of it doesn't. And especially the lighter stuff, it can get really lame on the bottom end. It can be really sweet on the top, but it can not have a lot of chunky low mids. And I'm kind of, I tend towards warm, compressed type of sounds acoustically from a guitar. I like that kind of tone.
Well, I remember the alder. Yeah. For us, a lot of my friends we had all sorts of years of Strats, and the cool sound to me was like an early 60s or a 50s style pickup if you were using a newer pickup, but the alder body for like Clapton, the alder with the maple neck had that sound.
Yeah.
Hendrix was more alder rosewood.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But it was always, we always desired the alder for the Strats. It always sounded really cool.
Yeah.
Now, But the top wood now.
Right. Well, that was really just an accident. You know, like, he said, well, why don't we build a fancy guitar? So he said, well, what, you know, what? Let's just try some good-looking top woods. And I started experimenting with not only the woods, but the thickness of the wood,
right.
How thick the top was. And, you know, experimented with maple as a top, you know, flame maple quilted and all that. And, you know, I started out with quarter-inch tops, and they were too bright. The guitars just sounded too bright. When I went back to a greater proportion of alder and less a thinner piece of maple, suddenly, bingo, there it was. And it was amazing because with a 3/16 top, you get the... It's like putting chocolate sauce on vanilla ice cream, you know.
Okay.
You take a bite of vanilla ice cream, you get a little bit of chocolate sauce in there. You get the taste of chocolate, but it's still vanilla.
Right.
You know, and that's kind of the way it was with the sound. Like you didn't lose that gorgeous low mid range, but you gained that little sparkly stuff on top that alder doesn't typically have. It doesn't have a lot of real sparkly top end.
Do you do any aging to your wood? Do you like the maple or the...
We don't do like any kind of extreme type of aging, but we do like a really rigorous drying process with everything so that our stuff is really, really dry. Like we do moisture tests and all that stuff. So our stuff is really low moisture content.
Yeah. And they're made here, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. California's... fairly dry.
Yeah.
Well,
our stuff is made in Arcata, California.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but even how dry California is, they still have to... You get it down to like 4% or something.
Yeah,
like that.
You got to get it dried out because what makes... first of all, they're heavier if they're wet. And just on a cellular level, when those... You know, wood is made up of cellulose. It's got a lot of little chambers in it, which are made up of that cellulose material. And when the moisture evaporates out of it, you're left with these little tiny microscopic pockets of cellulose. And that's why dry older guitars sound so great, because they've had a chance to really shed the moisture, and they're these kind of shells of these tiny little microscopic cellulose chambers, which transmit sound really well.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, you know, there's a cutoff point, you know, too. But again, with weight, for instance, if a guitar is too light, and I've experienced this with Swamp Ash, for instance, one of the reasons I love Swamp Ash, and some of the my favorite guitars were Swamp Ash, but it was not reliable as far as guitar to guitar. You couldn't count on it, you know.
Yeah.
Once you got it down around below 4 pounds, which is kind of our cutoff, we don't like body weight of over 4 pounds, you know, just the body. The wood started to get unreliable. You know, we would get one would be really lack bottom end, one would be very thin and brittle sounding.
Mm-hmm.
I need that consistency. I needed that consistency, you know, so that I could really count on that low warm mid range more than any other factor, you know, for me. That's kind of has to be, you know, you have to instantly feel that when you pick up one of my guitars.
Now what? Okay, I know from like even Les Pauls with the maple top, it gave it more bite and more bright. Mm-hmm. It gave it a little more top end. What about the other woods? The spruce, for instance, sugar pine.
Like Swamp Ash is. What the wonderful, that's, you know, maybe my favorite, just acoustically, just the sonics of the alder Swamp Ash combination. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to beat that because the Swamp Ash, without being too bright, it's brighter, it's sweeter sounding. But I go back and forth depending on the kind of music I'm playing. I go back and forth between the Swamp Ash tops, which would be what we call our lead pro.
Mm-hmm.
And the maple tops, which would be either the Blues Pro or the Signature Elite for us. Those are the maple tops.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Signature Elite, and they tend to be more aggressive, more top end, a little brighter sounding, and they're great for rock or more aggressive kind of stuff, more aggressive blues. If you tend towards more.
Thank you.
that's got that kind of rock thing.
It's got you know, it's interesting now. He's got that, what we call that spank to it, you know, when you were playing the cleaner rhythm thing. Mm-hmm. And he's using humbuckers on there. Normally you would associate that with a single coil.
Right, exactly. Well, that's sort of a function of the, what we call the rhythm lead switch, which is actually just a series parallel switch with a little special circuit that I kind of stuck in there, which matches the high-end content between the parallel setting, which is the weaker setting, and the series setting, which is the brighter.
So you're not splitting the coils.
No. That's why
that's amazing.
It stays hum-canceling.
Right.
Right, because otherwise it you're right back to square one.
It's really quiet, and we have fluorescent lights here, and it's handling it.
Yeah. You don't usually get that kind of transparency out of a humbucking. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to happen. So, but you can hear, like, if you listen when I switch back and forth between series and parallel.
Got a much meatier.
It sounds like a boost. Yeah. It's not. It's just going into series. But listen to the high end content. It stays the same.
Yeah.
And that's, I spent a long time experimenting with values, because what's called a passive tone network, which is really just a resistor and a capacitor to ground, mm-hmm. in parallel with the pickup, it acts like a preset tone pot. Mm-hmm. Like if you had a second tone pot inside your guitar with a preset value, mm-hmm. and it just rolls off that excess top end that you get when you put a sort of vintage output humbucking into parallel. Usually they got a lot of excess high end that kind of destroys the usefulness of the mm-hmm. pickup, especially with overdrive.
Okay.
Right.
That switch is the toggle switch, right?
Yeah, that's the mini toggle.
Because he has a toggle switch on there, and then he has the three position switch, like a Strat.
Try to keep this guitar as simple as possible. I mean, I actually didn't set out to design a line of guitars. What happened was I realized after experimenting with these various things, especially the rhythm lead switch and all that, for about 9 years, I realized that I hadn't been to a guitar repair shop. That I was just playing all the time. I was doing session work. I was touring. I was just loving my sound. I was loving the way the guitar worked. And that's when I realized, wow, man, you know, for the first 30 plus years, I was every week I was at some luthier and others asking them to please change their pickups or change this or change mm-hmm. that. And I realized for 9 years I hadn't changed anything. And I was just delighted with the sound.
Wow.
So that's when I realized, you know what? I bet other players would like this, not just me. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's mm-hmm. when I started to kind of show it around to different people, and you know, and people seem to like, you know, like those features, like the, you know, having a
Well, it's
solo.
Definitely that's yeah. For as a session guy, those type of things to change the fact that you can get that difference without splitting the coil is amazing. I mean, that's,
right. Well,
and that's important.
Yeah, well, that, you know, there's not a lot of people as crazy as I am willing to sit there with, you know, boxes of resistors and capacitors and trying every combination until you get to the one that sounds right. You know, so it's really just, a lot of it is just being persevering, you know, mm-hmm, through, mm-hmm. you know, well, if I get something in my head that I want, you know, I become obsessed with it until I solve it or mm-hmm. really get like a serious roadblock where it says, okay, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about your bridge? Because that looks a little bit different than what I've seen. I mean, you've got a screw right there in the middle. But
yeah,
it looks
absolutely.
Like you've got a mixture of metals there, brass.
I went through a long process to find this bridge. Mm-hmm. And this is my saddle design. These are machined brass. Mm-hmm. These aren't just, you know.
Now, do you do anything to the brass so they don't tarnish? Are they coated?
No.
Or
no, we let them tarnish.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No. I like them tarnished. A lot of people seem to like them tarnished like that. Anyway, you know, I again, when the saddle design, I came up with a barrel diameter that was just the right diameter to give you that bendability, to give you the sound transfer and all that stuff. And also I designed the intonation, the portion of the saddle that extends backwards to accept the intonation screw. I made those flat so that you can rest your hand on it easily.
Yeah, that's right. Nice.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. But I could not find a bridge, and I defy you to find this, that's wider spacing than 2 1/8 that's top loading. Not in the United States. You're not going to find one.
Not
with that spacing.
Are the strings going through the body through the back?
No.
Really?
No, the strings load from the back of the bridge.
Oh, wow.
It's a top load. No holes. And that's why these guitars feel soft under your hands. That was just one of the things that I just had to have in a bridge. It has to be top loading.
So going through the body makes
it's a no-no for me.
Okay, but I mean, that makes the tension.
It stiffens up. It's incredibly stiff.
Okay.
It just makes it's very difficult to get a soft feel out of a bridge like that. Now, especially using traditional saddle design, I've been experimenting with something I can't talk about yet, but that's a different way to do this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know if you guys have ever experienced this, but the relative height of the treble and bass side of the saddle,
mm-hmm.
if you adjust them all so they're parallel to the top, most of the time the guitars feel really stiff.
Yeah, I agree. I've seen it.
Either with the string through or with the top load.
Because I have like a B-style Strat, and I've adjusted the bridge so it curves. You got to be careful because you can fret out when you bend, but yeah, it is easier to play.
Right. Now, that is just a characteristic of two height adjustment screws.
Okay.
So I'm on the trail of a single height adjustment screw bridge.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
Yeah.
Now, this
does
one
away with that.
This one that you have right now, are you adjusting to the contour of the
yeah,
neck?
Yeah, of course.
The
but,
frets?
Yeah, of course. And also, you can't really see it too well here, but the treble sides of the saddles are lower than the bass side slightly.
Right.
Now, and if anybody out there that has a guitar that's stiff, I strongly suggest that you try this. You don't have to change the height of the string, but just change, like if you raise the bass side and lower the treble side slightly so that the saddle sits at a slight angle, especially the low E
mm-hmm.
and A string, believe it or not, doing that to the low E and A string will make the high E string and B string way easier to bend.
Really?
The high strings.
Right,
now,
right, right.
You explain
you're
that
not
to
even
me.
Yeah, you're not even touching those.
Explain that to me, but I bet you $100 right now. If you try that, that's what you'll see, and not just a small difference,
mm-hmm.
a big difference.
Big difference,
yeah.
Now, what's your opinions and theories on once you go past the nut, the angle there? How steep of an angle do you have on the strings? I see you have like a tree there.
Oh yeah, well I try to keep it as gentle as possible.
So you don't want a high degree of a...
No, I don't like to do that because a couple of things. First of all, it increases... I like to keep as much bendability as possible. I like to make the strings have to feel... I like them to feel kind of buttery and soft and easy to bend under the hands. And that's just what
so
I like.
So it's the same principle where at the bridge, so you don't have
right.
as much of an angle.
Same principle.
It makes it easier to bend.
Yeah, it's the same on acoustics, too. It's mm-hmm. it's no difference. It's like the more break angle you put over those things, the more, first of all, string tension you're creating. And the second thing you're doing is you are creating more string tension at the first fret.
Yeah.
Because in physics, for an extreme example, if you're going to make that at a right angle or make it a very extreme angle, that increased tension extends partway up the string past the nut. So that's what you're
going to
feel.
Yeah, I've noticed that. It's hard to, like on some of the Floyds with the bar that push the strings down.
Right.
You have that. It's
right.
harder to hit that F chord.
You notice that all my guitars have a shelf nut. The nut overhangs the fingerboard slightly.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was looking. I was trying to figure out if you had a zero nut on there.
Now, why is that?
That is, it's partly for tuning reasons to put the witness point of the nut slightly closer to the first fret, but it's mostly because I could just relocate the nut too and accomplish the same thing.
Right.
Why not just do that? the reason for it is that it increases by 30% the surface area that the string makes contact with the nut. That's the first thing. So it has much more area to dissipate that extra string tension. Mm-hmm. That's why on my guitars, they tend to feel very soft and buttery at the first few frets. And you also don't get that pitch distortion.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right? So let me ask you this then. So one of the reasons why people, I think, have the string angle higher is for sustain. So how do you get sustain?
That's a misconception.
Okay.
increasing the angle, creating more down pressure, excessive down pressure on either a saddle or a nut, does not increase sustain. It does not increase sustain. What it does is it decreases sustain by creating excess tension. The string touches the guitar at four places: at the tuner, the ball end of the string, the saddle, the nut, and the tuner. In the case of the high E and B, in five places of the string tree. So the string has an optimum tension that it wants to vibrate at, right? And so what I believe is that you want to interrupt it as little as possible between its capture points, meaning the ball end of the string and the tuner.
Okay.
You want to interfere as little as possible with the string to let it vibrate at its maximum. Right? So what would be, if I force this thing down a lot, right? What it's doing is it's creating a new witness point.
Right.
It's adding a witness point, right? So every time you add a witness point, every time you add contact, something that contacts the string, you're interfering with its vibration. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's the reason why. I believe that everything needs to be at a nice gentle angle, a gentle angle over the saddle, gentle angle over the nut, to allow the string to vibrate freely. And it's the same idea. It's the same theory. I believe that every part on the guitar has its own optimum resonant frequency. For instance, the neck is a separate piece of wood from the body. It's not, they're not glued together. Right? They're separate.
Right, yeah, yours is bolted.
Right, so that's why I have a very specific amount of torque that I like to apply when I put a neck on a body. And I don't tighten it as tight as it'll go, which a lot of people do that, you know? Because they think, well, if it's tighter, it's better, right? It's got to be better because it's going to be more vibration. Exactly the opposite.
Did you do any experiments with, a lot of guitars are neck through where it's all one piece of wood?
Yeah, sure.
What did you think of that?
I'm not a fan of neck throughs, and not so much because of the neck through design, but because of the neck angle.
Okay.
Most of them have a positive neck angle that puts the bridge way up high. Mm.
Yeah, right? His bridge is pretty low.
Now, nylon string, classic guitar builders have known for hundreds of years that the more positive neck angle, meaning the neck slopes down.
Yeah, it's angling more.
And puts the bridge up higher. They're louder, but you start to decrease bass response. You lose bottom end. The more positive neck angle, the less bottom end. That's why most jazz guitars have no bottom end. Zero. So it's because of that positive neck angle. That's why I'm not a huge fan of the Les Paul design of the other neck throughs. Not so much because of that, but because of the neck angle.
Yeah. Yeah, the Les Pauls are angled, yeah. So right. That's how you get the old...
This is my personal preferences. Yeah. They're fantastic.
Well, no, that's the thing, is everything that you did has a reason for it.
For me.
Yeah, yeah. And that's cool.
Yeah, the other thing that I want to make clear is that I don't pretend to be a guitar expert, like a luthery expert. I'm absolutely not an expert in luthery, but I can honestly say that I know as much as anybody about the way guitars perform
Well, what the things that you've discovered, there's evidence. I mean, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, and so I just report observations.
Right, right.
That's why I don't try to argue with people or convince them of my theories or claim that I'm right, because I have no idea. I just know what I've observed and what works for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have any opinions, or have you tested out? Like, I've seen, like, I think it's Paul Reed Smith, where you actually see him knocking on the wood of the body and knocking on the neck, and I think he tries to make them the same pitch, if I remember. I could be totally wrong. And then I think I've seen Steve Vai try to have complementary pitches of his neck and his body. Have you done any experimenting with that? You have any thoughts on that?
I have not. Matter of fact, that's the first thing I've ever heard about that.
Oh, that's a
try it.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious, because I always wondered, you know, if it's any voodoo or not to that.
You know? Yeah, you know, I'm sure it's not voodoo. I'm sure that Paul Reed Smith is a very smart guy, and Steve Vai is also. So
yeah.
If those guys are willing to do that, then I'm sure that there's a reason for it.
And I apologize if I got that backwards for anyone.
I certainly wouldn't dismiss it. Yeah. That's for sure. Yeah.
Now, Buzz, I have a question for you. Now, I noticed that you have the machine brass bridge. Did you try a brass nut? What did you think? Or what are you using? What is the material of that?
It's machine bone.
Actual bone?
Yeah, it's actual bone that's machined.
Okay.
On CNC machine.
Okay. But any reason why you didn't go brass and brass?
Well, brass to me is not a good material for a nut.
Okay. I remember there was a big fad in the late 70s for sustain and stuff.
You know, the nut is incredibly important, in my opinion. It's hugely important on a number of levels. It's hugely important for sound reasons, first of all. That's why we never super glue our nuts in. The nut is tapped in with a plastic mallet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sized very carefully with a sanding block and then tapped in with a mallet.
Interesting.
And that's, like, I insist on that. Like, everybody kept saying, no, you got to glue it in, man. Just glue it in. Just glue it in. Because we can't make it that perfect every time. I said, yes, you can.
Don't have any problems with it popping off.
No. Well, we used to because the guys would get in a hurry, or they get lazy, or they get sloppy, and they oversand it, and they want to just not have to make another one. You know, but and then I yelled at him. I said, no, you have to make another one.
Interesting.
but nylon string guitar makers have known this for hundreds of years. If you play or look at an expensive, really good classical guitar, they do not glue the nut in. They hand fit it,
yeah.
And they sit there until it fits right. And if it's well fit, it will never come out unless you want to take it out. And not only that, and again, it follows my belief or my observation that these parts vibrate at a molecular level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one part excites the next part that it's attached to, right? Mm-hmm. So if I glue the nut to the neck, then it's no longer two parts. It's one part, right? So the nut can't do its job. The nut's job is to excite the neck.
Mm-hmm.
You with me?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's to excite the neck. Those strings, there's not enough energy in the strings to vibrate the whole neck by themselves. Mm-hmm. They need help from the nut, because that's the next bigger thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the strings attach to a slightly bigger thing, which is the nut. That attaches to a much bigger thing, which is the neck. Same thing with a guitar bridge. The string attaches to the ball end, gets captured by the back edge of the bridge. Then the string passes over the saddle, right? The saddle rests on a base plate, right? The base plate rests on the top, right? Now, why don't we just attach the string to the body? Why go through all that? Let's just attach the string to the body. Why do we have to bother with any of that? And that's because each part excites the next part.
Mm-hmm.
And then the parts get larger and larger, and that's when the guitar starts to sing.
Mm-hmm.
When it starts to sing and give you something back, because all those little parts are able to do their jobs, which is to excite the part that it's attached to. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's my intuitive knowledge about the guitar.
Now, he just laid the guitar in his lap like he was going to play like a lap steel. And I'm looking at it from where I'm sitting, and it's pretty flat. I mean, there's no tilt in the neck. It's pretty from the bridge. There's very little bending. It's almost straight. Mm-hmm. Even from the nut to the string tree and the tuners, it's pretty...
Very gentle.
Very gentle
very
slope.
Gentle,
not much slope
slight,
at all.
Very slight angles.
And it's amazing the sustain you're getting, because that was... Yeah, it's just amazing.
They're allowed. That's because the string... This because nothing has to work too hard. Nothing has to work too hard. The string has its optimum... frequency that wants to, that it's going to move that saddle, vibrate that saddle most efficiently.
Yeah.
If I force it down too hard, then it's going to prevent the saddle from vibrating.
Now, do me a favor and just bend like a blues note and just hold it so they can get an idea of the sustain.
It's got a noise gate on it. Let me get rid of that so we can just...
Because I was playing with this a little before, and it's sustained. It's pretty. It's
still running. Going.
Yeah, it's still going.
Still going.
So yeah, what you're talking about, it makes sense. It's all there. Now let me ask you this. Now we've gone through the nut and the bridge, the pickups. Are these those Alnico 5s?
They sure are.
Now, why Alnico 5? I've heard of Alnico pickups, but there's different. There's Alnico 4, Alnico 3.
Well, just thank you. really, it's just trial and error. I mean, okay. I tried these pickups with Alnico 2. I don't know if there's an Alnico 4, frankly.
Oh, okay. I thought I heard of an Alnico, but I may be wrong. It could be the speakers. I don't know. There's Alnico speakers too.
Yeah. Anyway.
What was the difference? Let's look at that.
The Alnico 5s were smoother to me than the Alnico 2s.
And what's the difference?
Technically, I have no idea.
It's not
I just
the
know
con-end?
It's a type of, magnet.
Hmm. Oh, okay. But it's not the ratio.
But the sound to you was better to have the 5s.
Yeah, to me it was more compressed sounding and less edgy. Mm-hmm. It was a little... The Alnico 2s to me were a little too... they weren't quite warm enough. They were a little harsh sounding. It's the only word I can describe it. A little harsh, a little brittle sounding.
Right.
And I prefer... sounds that are warmer, more naturally compressed sounding. Mm-hmm. And also, that's why, I don't know if you can see it in this, but you'll notice that the bridge humbucking is narrower spaced pole pieces than belongs on the guitar.
Oh, it's narrower than where it's a little more in from the strings?
And that's on purpose. It's a little inboard of the strings, and I do that because... After experimenting with it both ways, with the correct quote-unquote spacing and the narrower spacing, the pickup with the narrower spacing has a whole different capacitance, whole different tonal character than the correct one, right? The correct one sounded more brittle, more, too harsh to me.
Mm-hmm.
And this one... Just the quality of the pickup itself sounded warmer and more just juicier. I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask you, I think we'd be doing a disservice if we didn't talk about some of it. Tuning. So can you tell our listeners why, just tuning straight 440 without doing any kind of tempered tuning, why that doesn't work on a guitar and why, I don't know if you can demonstrate that at all.
Well, I can't demonstrate on this guitar because this one is not set up like that, but I can I can describe a phenomenon that I'm sure all of your listeners that play guitar have experienced. You get your guitar perfectly in tune to the tuner, and you play a bar A chord at the 5th fret, and it's perfect. Life is great. You're loving life. And then you play a bar D chord at the 5th fret, and it's horribly out of tune.
Yes.
Anybody ever experienced that? Every hand in the house
My
goes
hands up.
Every hand in the house goes up. Okay. That's the brick wall of traditional intonation. That's just a brick wall. You're not going to get both those chords out of traditional tuning and intonation. It's not going to happen.
Why is that? I thought it was because the guitar wasn't made right. Or the bridge was in the wrong spot.
Mm-mm. The reason is that each string has its own sort of magic set of numbers. Each string has its own preferred place where when you intonate it at the 12th fret, you know, for instance, when you play it open, where you just sounds in tune to you, right? And typically it's 2 cents, the overtone is 2 cents sharp. When it sounds in tune, the overtone, not the fundamental, the overtone, I'm sorry, let me switch that off. That's a big no-no in radio. Huh?
It's all right. It's
a special effects on his guitar. You get that telephone ring. It's a.
Anyway.
I did it last week. So.
Yeah, that's anyway, typically, that's where our ears want to hear it. Not the fundamental, but the overtone is too sharp. So each string, when it's in tune with itself at the 12th fret, is not in tune with the tuner.
Okay.
Okay? When it sounds right, if you make it to a tuner, it's not going to sound right to itself, right? And one of the things that I borrowed from piano tuning when I invented the Buzzfeed tuning system was discovered by a German piano tuner named Werkmeister. And he figured out that the ear, like with the interval of a fifth, right, or fourth, that our ears will tolerate quite a bit of pitch adjustment. In other words, you can borrow pitch from those intervals, from fourths, fifths, and octaves, right? But our ears will not tolerate any sharpness from a third, right, or a sixth, right?
Yeah.
The ear that we do not want to hear those intervals sharp, right? Matter of fact, our ears prefer them tuned about 17 cents flat.
Yeah.
That's where like a perfect tuned third beatless.
Wow.
It's actually 17 cents flat. It's like ridiculous. So that being said, what I was trying to do when I came up with the tuning system was to borrow pitch from those fourths, fifths, and octaves to sweeten up the thirds and sixths.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically the same philosophy as piano tuning. It's not any different. I just had, it was because it's not a keyboard, and and one string has to be more than one position in a chord, right? So it's a little different, a little trickier, but it's the same idea.
Right.
And so basically I found like sort of these magic pairs of numbers that that you know made the guitar just more pleasant sounding.
Yeah.
And I would never claim that anything sounds quote unquote perfect.
Yeah.
Because you're in a world of trouble if you claim that.
Well, I remember perfect. It's a similar principle with the piano. You have to temper the piano. It can't be. And we were just talking with Scott's dad last week with the pedal steel. And if you tune it to pitch, it'll play to itself, but it won't play with the band.
Right.
So he has to temper. There are tempered tunings that, you know. I have another question for you real quick. We're almost out of time, and I want to get to the neck.
Sure.
But on your pickups, a lot of your models have single-coil type pickups. Now, are those humbuckers?
Yes.
Are they stacked? And so they still function the same?
Yeah, they're still hum-canceling.
Okay, and those are Alnicos too?
Yes.
Alnico 5s. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's get into the neck a little bit.
Sure.
That's what we had originally talked about before the show last time you were here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating what you discovered with the neck. Can you kind of go through what you were looking for when you were developing the neck and how the difference in the shape and where in the shape over on the bass side or the treble side of the neck? Could you just go
through? Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I tend to... I like a neck that supports a lot of string bending. I do a lot of string bending, and the knuckle of your first finger on your left hand, if you're a right-handed guitar player, that's what supports the string bend. That's a fulcrum.
Right.
That's a fulcrum, and usually your second or third finger acts. That's the note you're playing, but that knuckle is very important.
Mm-hmm.
So the distance, the relation, you know, how much support you have for that knuckle on the treble side of the neck, just below the fingerboard, is terribly important. If it's over-sanded there and you don't have enough wood there, then you're always feeling like you're not having enough support for string bending. That's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing, on the bass side of the neck, you want to feel like you have access, like you can't have too much shoulder. So it's kind of the reverse. Like on the treble side, I like a lot of shoulder, so there's plenty of support for the knuckle. But on the bass side, I like it to kind of right away, right underneath the fingerboard, curve away very quickly. So, and with a nice, gentle, consistent curve, mm-hmm. not a V, but it's just nice, consistent curve. So that you
feel it's almost like an asymmetrical type of approach.
Very slightly.
Yeah.
Very slightly. It's not one of those wild looking, but it's exactly the reverse asymmetry of an asymmetrical neck in mm-hmm. that usually asymmetrical necks have big rails on the bass side and skinny rails on the treble side. And my experience is exactly the opposite.
So the bass side is more of like a slimmer taper.
True.
And the treble side is more like a rounded taper.
More rounded, right. And, I can play anything. I can really play, any kind, a lot of different kinds of necks and get comfortable with it because, but in a perfect world, the shape that I seem most comfortable with is not too huge, not too small, but something kind of in the middle with a lot of meat on the treble side, a lot of rail on the treble side, and not too much on the bass side.
Yeah, well, no, I've tried necks that are almost like squared off, similar to like a classical guitar, where the bass side of the neck.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine had a guitar. It was a prototype, and he said, "Try this. It's really bothering me."
Yeah.
And I played it. I could bend on it, mm-hmm. but after about 10 minutes, my thumb
mm-hmm.
hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was amazed because it was like, "What's going on?" I usually don't. And then I went to my Les Paul or my Fender, and I played that and it was fine.
Right.
So yeah, and it was more. It was a thicker.
Chunkier
type of thing on the bass side, and then smooth. Yeah. It was the reverse, like you were saying, and it made a difference.
Oh, big time! And I kind of, to be honest with you, I mean, I didn't start out knowing how to shape necks.
Mm-hmm.
I never really did that, to be honest. Only when I started building guitars, which is fairly recently, did I really get into neck shaping. And I taught myself how to shape necks by screwing up a lot of necks.
Yeah, but really? But what you're saying, that knowledge of the shallower bass mm-hmm, side and the mm-hmm. chunkier,
yeah.
That's amazing. I mean, that's important because it really does make a difference.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I really analyzed it. I really sat down and tried to analyze it, like pick it apart.
Mm-hmm.
Why does this one feel good and that one feels bad? Why? What's the difference?
Mm-hmm.
And that's also when I discovered that phenomenon that I showed you guys with the sanding sponge, where you can take so little off, you can't even measure how little wood you take off, but your hands perceive it as a football field.
Huh.
It's
really, it is noticeable. And we made a video. You'll have to look at the video and see what he did. But he just like with a little bit of sandpaper, just like scraped it a couple of times.
Sandpaper sponge.
Sanding sponge. Yeah, you can't even not even taking wood off.
The finish was it wasn't rough. It was really smooth. But just that like one or two swipes of it, it was noticeable.
Yeah,
that was really noticeable.
Our hands perceive things, when they're connected to our brain. That you can't measure.
Mm-hmm.
They're so small you can't measure them. So you have to be careful when you start to change things. That's the other thing that I would caution people about. Guitars that you love, if you have a neck that you love, don't change it. Don't refinish it. Don't
mm-hmm.
do anything to it. Because the minute you add finish, you're adding about anywhere between 3 and 5 thousandths of an inch of finish to that neck, and you're going to feel it. It's going to feel huge to you.
Yeah.
Or the reverse. If you love your neck, we say, well, I think I want to make it faster, so maybe I'll shave it down on the back. Maybe I'll sand the back mm-hmm. of the neck. You can do that, but it will totally change the way the neck, the way you perceive the neck.
Mm. Now, one thing about the neck, too, that we never talked about, but I'm curious about if you did some research, is the scale. Is that I forget the different
25
scale.
And a half.
Is that the Fender scale or the Gibson scale?
This particular one is a Fender scale.
Now, do you do both?
Currently, we're offering the 25 and a half inch, mm-hmm. although I am working on a couple of different scales that are really interesting.
What did you discover with scale?
Well, what I discovered with scale, and one of the things that I kept noticing just about my own personal preferences, is that I prefer my guitars tuned to E flat.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is the string tension. Like, the guitars just seem to sing better, they speak better.
What gauge are you using?
With any gauge.
Oh, okay.
Nines, tens, doesn't matter.
Because I found with, like, Les Pauls, my Gibsons have tens.
Right.
And my Fenders have nines,
right.
And it feels about the same.
Right.
So
exactly.
The tension, scale affects
string
the tension.
Big time. So I'm working with a scale length right now of a neck that I've built that's 25 and a quarter,
mm-hmm.
which is quarter an inch shorter than Fender and a quarter of an inch longer than, like, PRS. So it's right in the middle.
How's
yeah,
it feel?
So I thought, because PRS is in the middle of Fender and Gibson.
Right, so I wanted to even split that in half, and because I like the Fender scale basically, but I wanted to try a scale length that would feel, when it's tuned to E, would feel like E-flat, which is why I kind of experimented. So jury's still out on that. I haven't really finished, you know, screwing
around. You got to let us know
what
you come up with.
But, man, it's really cool. My first impression is that it's a winner. Is that it sounds fantastic. It sounds bigger than the longer scale.
Really?
Yeah, because it's not as tight.
Really?
It's like, you know, like Les Pauls often sound huge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, amplified, they just sound huge. They've got all the sustain. It's enormous sustain. And a lot of it is because of the scale length. Because it's a really short scale and really fat strings. And you get that...
I have to try my friend's Birdland with those shorts. As he
Yeah, I'm telling you, man.
No,
you
know, Ted Nugent liked those. I mean, they're
it's only delays, practically.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can put 10s or 11s on Les Paul all day long and play it.
I have to try. My Jaguar has a short scale, too. It's a shorter scale. And the Mustang, I think the Fender Mustang, too. Well, we're out of time. And I just want to let everybody know, you got to check out www.buzzfeetandguitars.com and also BuzzFeet and Guitars on Facebook. And check it out, because all the stuff that he's talking about, it's on the site, and he talks, and you can see the different guitars in the woods, and there's plenty of video, so you can hear the sound, you can hear what he's talking about. And Buzz, thank you so much for being on. It's just really great to have. We got to have you back.
Hey, awesome, man.
I want to hear that new guitar with the new scale.
We should have him play out.
Yes.
When you get to be in sort of your sunset years, like I am, you know, the old guys like to go on and on. You know, and that's what happens.
Well, we also want to thank Sweetwater for sponsoring the show, and I actually said that properly. So hey, congratulations
there you go.
To me.
Good for you. No, no, that's great. And we'll be posting pictures and also sorts of stuff on our coverage of the NAMM show. Buzz, can you kind of give us a little thing to take us out and playing on the guitar? Just kind of wail a little bit?
I can try.
You
can
try.
You know.
I think you can more than try.
Well, I don't know about that, man.